he mentioned, I'm Jeff Mackey. I'm on staff here, among other things, as Director of Student Life. I'm also on the faculty of St. Cyril and Methodius Byzantine Catholic Seminary in Pittsburgh. And I'm honored to have been asked to moderate this portion. Thanks, Joel. Our next speaker did his undergraduate studies at Villanova University and then went on to complete his PhD from the University of Chicago before returning to his alma mater as a faculty member. Today, he's the chair of the Humanities Department at Villanova, where he specializes in medieval and early modern theology and culture. His writings include Church History, Faith Handed On, and Constructing Antichrist, Paul, Biblical Commentary, and the Development of Doctrine in the Early Middle Ages, which our program says is forthcoming, but I think we have it. It's in the bookstore. He's the co-editor of Augustine and Politics and Augustine and Liberal Education, and has had articles appear in Modern Theology, Franciscan Studies, and the Heythrop Journal. He's done work on Augustine, Francis, and Henri Delubac, as well as a work in progress on St. Bonaventure's Collationes in Hexaemeron. Today he'll be, as you see in your program, speaking to us on the Franciscan tradition. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Kevin Hughes.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks, that was a very kind introduction. Generous, all those things. Yes, the book is out. The forthcoming was when it was coming out in paperback, because it's been out in hard, so it's out, and you'll see it out there. But if you want to hear all about 2 Thessalonians, more than you ever wanted to know. Well, I'm so pleased to be here, and some of you know I came in. My daughter graduated from high school yesterday, and so I couldn't be with you yesterday in the morning. So I'm so happy to be able to join late in the game. And having heard Joel's summary, I'm all the sadder that I missed what sounds like a great conversation. And I'm happy to join in. I'm always eager to join in a conversation when I hear, especially a good one that's going. I suspect that the story of Francis of Assisi is somewhat familiar to most, if not all, in the room. But just to catch you up in case, at the end of the 12th century, a young man, son of a cloth merchant, he was in search of a chivalrous life, and he discovered God's call to him in the rejection of the very material wealth that had made his family a success story in the new, upwardly mobile merchant class. Francis famously cast aside his father's wealth, and then even his father's clothes, this very dramatic scene in the city square where he strips naked and throws his clothes back at his father, entrusting himself to God as his father. He heard Christ speak to him from the crucifix in the chapel of San Damiano, saying, "Rebuild my church." And Francis was rather literal-minded, and so he took this command literally, and he rebuilt the chapel of St. Mary of the Angels, the chapel that has come to be called the Porziuncola, just outside Assisi in Umbria. Only later did he realize that God's command, how true is that for all of us? Only later did he realize that God's command had been more general, more metaphorical, more institutional. Only, that is, when people started coming to him and asked to join him in his way of life. Well, Francis's way of life caught fire. In 10 years, they went from 5 of his initial followers to 5,000. And by 1250, you know, just a couple decades later, some estimates were that there were 30,000 Franciscan friars spread throughout Western Europe. And indeed, the life of Francis has continued both to inspire and to offend. Francis can be a kind of scandalon, right? A kind of stumbling block. While his image has been domesticated for many, for Catholics like me, he's the second most popular garden statue. He still tends to ignite the fire in some, and he certainly did for me. I was 16 years old, and I had when I encountered his full story, the story behind the birdbath. I had just had at 16 what I might call an evangelical awakening, sitting in church and hearing the words that I had heard my whole life, but hearing them as if I had heard them for the first time. And so, not really knowing what to do, I was trolling around Christian bookstores for something to make sense of what was happening to me, and I first came across G.K. Chesterton's great short book, St. Francis of Assisi. That's a book no one today would call critical historical scholarship, and it's really as much poetry as it is prose. But it gave me a glimpse of Francis that after all these years of engaging that very critical scholarship has never been eclipsed or supplanted. But what was it exactly that spoke to me more than 30 years ago and that continues to speak to me and many others today? I hope to unpack that a little bit for you today and try to capture a little bit of that wisdom and see how we can put that into place or let it speak to us today. What attracted me to Francis, first of all, was the simplicity of his calling. Near the end of his life, Francis recalled his first sense of vocation with these words in his testament, his last statement. He says, "The Lord gave me, Brother Francis, thus to begin doing penance in this way. For when I was in sin, it seemed to me too bitter to see lepers, and the Lord himself led me among them and showed mercy, and I showed mercy to them. And then the Lord gave me brothers, and the Most High himself revealed to me that I should," and this is a key phrase for Francis, "that I should live according to the pattern of the gospel." That's it. God gave him the gift that what was repulsive to him became sweet, and then God called him to live according to the pattern of the gospel. And again, Francis is rather literal-minded, so he says, okay, that's what I'll do. And so he took the Sermon on the Mount, more or less, and made that his rule. When he first journeyed to Rome to get his new community approved by the Pope, the Pope had decided that there should be no new religious communities, no new rules. But Francis, kind of very clever in his way, right, said, well, here's my rule, the Sermon on the Mount. Is that okay with you? Francis essentially took the Sermon on the Mount and he lived it. In his earlier rule, Francis included 239 citations from Scripture, mostly from the Synoptic Gospels, in just 24 chapters that amount to about 25 pages in the contemporary English translation. That's a lot of Scripture jammed in there. Really, it's a catena. It's sort of a chain of the Sermon on the Mount and other Scripture filled in with, okay, so let's do that this way. You know, that's really the flavor that you get from the earlier rule. The simplicity of that appeal to the gospel appealed to me. Francis made the gospel livable. You know, when I teach the Sermon on the Mount to undergraduate students, the response is always like, he couldn't mean that, right? I mean, who looks on somebody with lust? Come on, right? You know, I mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? You know, the kind of hyperbole of the Sermon on the Mount just seems out of reach. And Francis was able to live what you might call a hyperbolic life to show how possible it is. So it's that simplicity of radical discipleship that I think is one of the first markers of the Franciscan life that I think is worthy of our attention. Sometimes we make it more complicated than it needs to be. And it's our fear, I think, that keeps us from that kind of commitment to the radically simple life that Jesus calls us to. All right, but it would be a mistake to think that this call to poverty was uniquely Franciscan. In fact, if we set in a little bit of historical context, I know, I'm going to bear with me. But Francis is one of many charismatic leaders of movements that seem to crop up in the late 12th and early 13th century. We could trace all the various dimensions of the social and the political and the economic and cultural renewal that seem to arise in what scholars have called the Renaissance of the 12th century. I won't do that for you all now, but I'm happy to answer questions about it if that comes up. But the short answer is this: a new commercial economy was pushing out the feudal economy of the earlier Middle Ages. Towns and cities and even city-states were growing in population and in influence. The popes of the 12th and 13th century undertook a broad program of reform and centralization that changed the shape of the church and changed its relationship to the world around it. But in the midst of all of that social and political change, we should recognize what we might call the movement of the Spirit, I think. As the great Dominican scholar Marie-Dominique Chanu once said, one should see the church in the 12th century, and he can't help himself but insert this, one should see the church of the 12th century, and it is a wonderful thing to see, shaken by the call of the gospel. There in the midst of feudal society, where bit by bit through the centuries, it had become comfortably and conveniently established. In response, movements of apostolic poverty began to crop up throughout Europe. The poor men of Lyon, the poor of Lombardy, these are all communities that shared a similar sense that their call to discipleship was a call of radical apostolic poverty. If you read the conversion story of a guy like Peter Waldo, or Valdez, depending on what translation and where your source is, from about 1173, you know, when Francis was, not born yet, yeah. It reads very much like that of Francis, and that's 10 years before Francis was even born, really. Peter Waldo and Francis are just two exemplary figures in an epochal shift in Christian self-understanding, in an emergent transformation of the sense that the vita apostolica, the apostolic life, had to be different. In the earlier monastic rules, say the rule of Benedict or the rule of Augustine, the apostolic life is modeled on a kind of exempt. If you wanted to say what's the key text of this, you know, a sort of key scriptural text that would capture the vision of the apostolic life. For the rule of Augustine and the rule of Benedict, it's Acts 4:32. Right? The community of those who believed was of one heart and one mind, and no one said any things which they possessed were his own, but they had everything in common. That vision of being of one heart, being of one mind, creating a community that lived apostolically, right, within the walls of the cloister, right? The apostolic life was cultivated within. But Peter Waldo and Francis looked to more outwardly directed models of the Vita Apostolica. So the key text for Francis is something more like Luke 9. Jesus sent them out to preach the kingdom of God and heal, and said to them, take nothing for your journey, no staff, no bag, no bread, no money, and do not have two tunics. Again, Francis says, okay, that's what we'll do. But that, you see how that's a different sort of model. It's a model of the apostolic life because with the revival of towns and cities, there's an apostolate to go to, right? So it's a model of being sent to an urban community to preach, to bear witness. And it becomes marked by this sense in that 12th century economic and cultural world by go and sell what you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me. So mendicant movements in general, and the Franciscans in particular, are itinerant movements. Rod mentioned last night the critique of the gyrovagues in the Rule of Benedict. That's one of the things that the Franciscans were accused of. They were wandering monks, aren't they? Aren't they just wandering around and sort of cherry picking from things? And Francis and his followers had to really defend. No, this is really Luke 9. Right. Franciscans, therefore, they tended to move in and out of the city and between cities. Their apostolate usually involved coming into a town during the day in groups of two or three, preaching, working, begging, caring for the poor, and then returning out to a house or a field on the outskirts of that town or city, regathering with their brothers and sharing the fruits of their labor and their begging. So they were kind of in this movement of in and out was really the sort of rhythm of Franciscan life. But all around them, in the 12th and 13th centuries, mendicant movements abound with varying degrees of intensity. And so we can look at, you know, the Dominicans are a mendicant movement, the Augustinians. I have to mention the Augustinians. I teach at Villanova. They're founded by Augustinians. So that's my paid political announcement. Carmelites, you know, all of these communities within the church are originally part of this mendicant movement, part of these mendicant movements that emerged in the 13th century. So it's interesting to note, perhaps in an aside, that what in a few years will be taken as the distinctive hallmark and trouble spot in the Franciscan movement, its dedication to radical apostolic poverty, is not really, in the first instance, all that unique to them, to their vocation. One of the things we might think about, we'll see if I have time to speak to it here, is what made the difference? How did they sort of hang on and become an issue for them when the other movements seemed to sort of disappear or fade? But apostolic poverty, I think, emerges as a kind of counter-movement, a counter-culture to the emergent commercial economy. Both Peter Waldo and Francis were newly rich, newly ascendant merchant class people. And both found the command to sell all you have as a fundamental summons to their discipleship. I think one way to think about the rule of Benedict in its context, where the radical obedience to the abbot is so important, right? That the rule of Benedict is, in a sense, a countercultural movement to a feudal way of thinking about things, right? In the feudal world, the commerce, the economy of things was loyalty and fealty. Oaths of obedience between lords and servants, lords and vassals, right? And so the Benedictine countercultural movement is say, let's recast that kind of obedience in this community in this way. In a similar way, then, Francis, Peter Waldo, these apostolic poverty movements are pushing back against a very particular sore point, a very particular neuralgic issue within their own cultural context to say, let's recast that. Let's retool that. Let's recapitulate that in a way that is transformed by the gospel. So Francis's particular vision of how to live this out and that way of life as it took shape in the early community of brothers makes it somewhat distinctive, but not, as I said, unique. For example, I already mentioned Francis casting his clothes away, right, and standing before the bishop. In this light, in the light of this sense of what to push against, takes on a little bit more symbolic weight than just the family drama that it clearly was anyway. By casting away his father's clothes, his father's livelihood as a cloth merchant, he was stepping away from the power and the prestige and the influence that such cloth brought. So this association of money and commerce with worldly power and prestige helps explain some curious passages in some of Francis's early writings, like the earlier rule that I've mentioned already. So here's a little passage here. Let none of the brothers, wherever he may go or be, carry, receive, or have received in any way coin or money, whether for clothing or books or payment or some work, indeed not for any reason, unless for an evident need of the sick brothers, because we should not think of coin or money as having any greater usefulness than stones. Bless you. So Francis is saying, you can beg for stuff, but you can't beg for money. You can't even touch it, right? There's a kind of absolute refusal to even approach or come close to it. We need to treat it like the stones. Why? I mean, just to continue, a little later he says, if we find coins anywhere, let us pay no more attention to them than the dust we trample underfoot. For vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I had a teacher once who would teach this passage, and he'd hold a dollar bill and say, so I can do, and he would rip it, and the students would be like, oh, it's a dollar, you know? But our reaction to that, right, to seeing money damaged, speaks something to our heart, right? I mean, it really is just a piece of paper. But there's a federal law, and it's money, right? I always used to say, so if I had a dollar, $10 lying on the ground, what should I do? And they'd say, stomp on it. I said, no, I'm not a Franciscan. I pick it up. But but he did. So Francis allowed himself and he allowed his brothers to beg for food, but not for money, because money became the token, the totem of a new kind of power, a new kind of self-elevation and self-inflation. The prohibition against even touching it is a refusal to enter into that game of signs, that sort of symbolic system that money represents. Again, if you flinch at the ripping of a piece of paper or the walking past some sum of money, right? Well, then it's telling you that you're sort of caught up in a system of signs, right? That's more than just paper, right? You're caught up in a culture, really, and you need to sort of think, wow, where does my heart lie? For similar reason, Francis forbid the friars from riding horses. You know, to us this is amazing. But a horse in the 13th century was the mark of prestige. If you could afford a horse and you could climb on the back of a horse and ride it, and you know, you were up higher than everybody, right? This was a sign of your place, of your status. And he says, let it not be lawful for them to ride horseback unless they are compelled by sickness or great need. By the way, this is one of the things I love about Francis too. He always puts this little, okay, this is absolutely what you must do unless somebody's sick, and then work with it. You know, practical reasoning at work in Francis here. Other symbolic gestures like this, other ways in which Francis pushes back against this kind of system of culture, the system of signs that I'm talking about. When he set out the governing structure of his order, you may know that the convention in Catholic communities like this is to call the leader the prior, right? And the local prior is the prior provincial, and then the prior of the whole is the prior general, right? Francis said, "Let no one be called prior." He just wanted to refuse that language. Why? Because the word prior means sort of first. Right? So who is the first? If you read the New Testament, if you read the Sermon on the Mount, being first ain't so great. You end up last. Right? So it's always been the practice for Franciscan communities to call their leadership ministers. You have the provincial minister, not the provincial prior. Right? You have the minister general, not the prior general. Or of a local community, they're the guardians, right? So in Rome, you can go to Rome, you can see there's the prior general of the Augustinians, the prior general of the Carmelites, of the Dominicans, and the minister general of all the various Franciscan communities there. So with all these various examples, we begin to get a richer sense, I hope, of Francis's name for this community of brothers. He calls them the Friars Minor. He instructs them that this is what they should be called. Minor or minor in Latin, right? Many will know, is a comparative adjective. It means lesser. So friars minor means more or less lesser brothers. It's tempting to sort of translate it colloquially as little brothers, but the lesser is really important dimension of what Francis is doing here. You know, there's in different circumstances, different audience, I said the Franciscan spirituality is a spirituality of yielding. Of being lesser. You say, then what? Well, then anyone you're around. You just try to be lesser. We can talk more about that later. But what you may not know as well is that that minor is a technical term in Italian politics of the 13th century. The minori are the poor, right? So when you declare yourself as a friar minor, right, you're saying, we are the friar among the poor, right? You're making a sort of argument of solidarity there. Right. Okay, to some this may seem like much ado about nothing. How am I doing? What, as they say, is in a name? Indeed, when I make this point at my home institution where they do have priors, they say, ah, come on! That's, you know, we don't mean that they're first, you know, we just mean that they're like taking charge, right? You know, right? It's hard to study Franciscans at an Augustinian institution, right? And, you know, it should be stipulated, it doesn't need to be stipulated, perhaps, that, like, the fact that you name yourself a minister general instead of a prior general doesn't mean you're necessarily less autocratic and whatever, you know, that we worry about from our authority. There have been plenty of bad minister generals, too, right? But to reduce it to pragmatic terms like this is to misunderstand what Francis is all about. For Francis and his early followers, their very lives, in all their detail, were symbols, were conveyors of meaning. I suspect everyone will have heard this saying that's attributed to Francis: proclaim the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words. Right. Now, I don't want to burst your bubble. I'm sorry. We don't think he said that, or if he did, we don't. But it's one of those things that he could have said and maybe should have said, because his life really bears that out in many ways. Not that he was afraid to use words. He used words all the time. But that he was also somebody who felt called to sort of find the dramatic action, to embody a dramatic way of being, and let that be the sign and the witness for him. So that's something powerful about the Franciscan vision. The life they lead, the materials they will touch or not touch, the animals they will ride or not ride, the titles they will hold or not hold, were a kind of proclamation, a visible sign of solidarity with the lowly and the lesser, and of their radical reliance on God. So the words and the gestures that frame and fill one's life, even in the smallest detail, for Francis, they matter. They're important. Because in great and small ways, they form in us a set of expectations, a horizon of expectation, or a horizon of what we think is normal. That's part of the ascetic impulse in general. The insight of asceticism is that every particular action can matter, right? We cultivate habits of eating and not eating, of sleeping and praying and working. Cultivate habits of those in an intentional way, because all of these can speak. But like I said, Francis is prone to hyperbole. And so this insight, I think, is captured hyperbolically in Francis and the Franciscan tradition. And what I would suggest is that sometimes we need that kind of hyperbolic action. We heard a great comment about Flannery O'Connor today, right? And Flannery O'Connor famously said, you know, she was getting a lot of grief for how much violence is in her stories. If you've ever read them, they can be pretty brutal. And she said, well, sometimes when you're living in a land of the hard of hearing, you have to shout. Right? And Francis is a shouter in that respect, right? That hyperbolic action that will wake us up to the radical simplicity of the call to discipleship. Okay. What I want to suggest to you is that for Francis and his early followers, the way of life itself is a kind of a sacramental, small s, sacramental reality, a visible sign of an invisible grace. So the early lives and stories are therefore completely littered with examples of dramatic hyperbolic actions by Francis or his companions. Let me share just one, because it's near and dear to my own heart as an academic. And I think it gives a good example of the kinds of things that Francis and his companions would do. So the story goes like this. There was a brother novice, and the brother novice could read. Not everybody could. So the brother novice asked his superior, his minister, if he could, his guardian, if he could have a psalter, just have a book of psalms that he could read and for his devotion. And the minister general sort of said, well, okay, I think that's fair. You know, you're a reading man, you could do that. But the young man was sort of earnest, and he felt a little scruple about it. And so he went to Francis himself and said, Francis, is it okay if I do this? And Francis's first impulse, according to the story, was say, okay, it's important that you obey your minister general, your minister, and so you should do what he says. And then the guy walked away, and as he walked away, Francis felt terrible. So he actually chased the guy down the road, and he made him turn around and come back right to the very spot where he had said it was okay. And then he unsaid its okayness. Right. So the brother was kind of confused by that, but he obeyed. But the same brother, a couple days later, said to Francis, please, could I do this? I'm still thinking about it. And Francis replied, I just love this. He said, brother, what will you do? After you have a psalter, you will want a breviary. You know, a bigger book. When you have a breviary, you will sit in a fancy chair like a prelate or a bishop and say, brother, bring me my breviary. The passage of the story continues. And speaking in this way with great intensity of spirit, Francis took some ashes in his hand and he put them on his head and he said, I, a breviary. It was really weird, right? But this is Francis, right? It's not the book itself. This would need 100 footnotes to really unpack. But what Francis is doing, it's not opposed to reading. He's not opposed to praying. What he's saying is your desire to have this thing might just be a desire to kind of insulate yourself, lift yourself up, elevate yourself, these sorts of things. And that identification of I and breviary. Francis, I think, is suggesting that it's that attachment to having this thing as a marker of who and what I am that is the temptation. The Briar says, it ends sort of laconically, right? The brother novice was stunned and ashamed. Well, yeah, I guess so. That's a story that we're still telling today, right? All right. With this and other examples, I hope I've given you at least some indication of the way the early Franciscans saw their very form of life as an opting out or a recasting of the system of signs that constitutes a culture. The early Franciscan community present one of the most radical examples of a counterculture precisely because it works its way out all the way down to the root level of words and signs. But it's important to say apostolic poverty and other such refusals were more than simply refusals. They brought with them the possibility of a different imagining of culture and community, a community of solidarity, not just with the poor, but with all creation. The clearing away of a culture's habit of self-elevation or pride creates the space for humility that connects the Franciscan community in fraternal relation to all creation, united in praise of God. You know, I was thinking about Rod pointing to McIntyre last night and saying, McIntyre saying, because of our wealth, the fragility of our own way of thinking may be invisible to us because we can kind of insulate ourselves from it. And so you can see that this Franciscan call is a way of sort of stripping away wealth in this particular instance as a way of insulating ourselves from the fragility of things. Right? But behind that fragility, not only of our moral order, but of our very existence, for Francis is not despair or terror, right, of the fragility of things, but gratitude. Because the fragility of our created being is that we are given into being constantly out of love by our loving Creator. And what Francis's ascetic disciplines do is strip away everything that would tend to prevent us from seeing that, from experiencing that, and from living that. Francis said in his earlier rule, therefore, let us desire nothing else. Let us wish for nothing else. Let nothing else please us and cause us delight except our Creator and Redeemer and Savior, the one true God who is the fullness of good, all good, every good, the true and supreme good, who alone is good. Hyperbole, right? Merciful, gentle, delectable, and sweet. Let nothing hinder us, nothing separate us, nothing come between us. Let all of us, wherever we are, in every place, in every hour, in every time of day, every day and continually believe truly and humbly and keep in our heart the most high and supreme eternal God, Trinity, and unity. That's his closing statement in the earlier rule. So this fraternal solidarity with all creation is demonstrated nowhere more clearly than in Francis's Canticle of the Creatures, sometimes called the Canticle of the Sun. Praise be you, my Lord, with all your creatures, especially Sir Brother Sun and Sister Moon, and you know that, perhaps. Right? That sense that we join in the praise with all creation and through all creation, and that we're allowed to do that, we're sort of able to do that precisely because we've stripped away all the things that we tend to use to push us away from it. Pope Francis, in his encyclical Laudato Si is actually a quote from the Canticle of the Creatures, the first line there, praise be you. He places that insight at the center of Laudato Si. He says, the poverty and austerity of St. Francis were no mere veneer of asceticism, but something much more radical, a refusal to turn reality into an object simply to be used or controlled. Right? So reality, all of reality, not just nature, not just the environment, but all of reality, including our brothers and sisters, are not objects to be used and controlled. Okay. So while poverty does later become the most controversial and notorious dimension of the Franciscan order, in the early communities, it's but one part of an integral ascetic program of kenosis, of emptying, of lowering, of lessering, of approaching a deep awareness of next to nothingness of oneself as a creature. Again, but the next to nothingness is not negation, it's gratitude. Because Francis's favorite title or form of address for God, you heard it in that last passage, is the Most High. God is the Most High. And the Friars Minor are the lowly, right? The lower. The prose poet Christian Bobin, one of my favorite writers, captures something right about Francis when he titles his prose poem on St. Francis, Très Bas, the Most Lowly. What we see in Francis and his brothers is a movement among movements, a movement of apostolic poverty that seems particularly responsive to the emerging commercial culture and economy and politics of his own age. But it is a movement that has the opportunity to deepen our reflection, his reflection and our reflection, on the significance of this kind of resistance and the insight it brings into matters beneath the level of economy and society. It's not simply a reactive social movement, but a community that allows a certain kind of very particular insight into their own cultural moment, yes, but they let that insight guide them into a much deeper insight into the life of discipleship and prayer that we all share. So that, I hope, gives us some sense into the very particular charisms or gifts of the Franciscan movement. Please note that I do this not as an attempt to counterpropose yet another option, a Francis option. I know, in fact, that Rod's seen quite a lot of counterproposals. We have a Dominican option. We have, you know, everybody's got their option. I mean, part of my sensibility as a Catholic is that we tend to contrast when we ought to complement. The richness of standing before or after a 2,000-year tradition is that there's such a wide plurality and beauty in the variety of ways that God has called his people. And that we can absorb many of those together, right? So I don't think actually, and this is something that maybe we'll have time to bear out in conversation, I don't think we should see these necessarily as contrastive options, right? But rather the radicalness of Francis is something that could easily be engaged with something like Rod is proposing in the Benedict option, not as another option. Okay, in the time remaining, I thought it'd be just useful, because maybe you're curious, to discuss the subsequent history of this radical movement. Because I think that too may have some valuable lessons for us as we think about our own countercultural practices. The story, in one sense, looks like many stories of institutionalization. It seems like a textbook case of Max Weber's movement from charismatic to institutional authority. Within Francis's own lifetime, the order had grown so big and become so complex and influential in the church that Francis himself says, I don't even recognize it sometimes. He certainly recognized at a certain point that he was not the person to lead this huge community of people, and he stepped aside and let somebody else take charge. Some of his earliest followers felt the same way. They retreated into the wilderness of the marches of Ancona in the eastern part, just north of Umbria, and as the rest of the order seemed to leave them behind. In many ways, the Franciscans became a victim of their success. As their numbers swelled, they brought new energy to the pastoral work of the church, and naturally they were asked by perceptive bishops and popes to take a leading role in the apostolic work of the church before them. But with greater responsibility came greater accountability, more need for training, specialized training, all these things. What had been founded as a predominantly lay movement of brothers quickly became more and more clerical because they had a responsibility to preach. As the percentage of ordained Franciscans grew, the sense that they needed to be properly educated and trained to be prepared for their apostolic work, that also grew. And so from rather early in the history of the Franciscans, they took up residence at the great universities, University of Paris above all. And that established a tension between the simplicity and humility of friars sleeping in the wilderness and the apostolic call to evangelize all nations and what it would require to do that. internally, the Franciscans constantly debated whether clerical training and study and all the modifications that that clerical training and study required of their life of simple poverty were betrayals or developments of the founding vision of Francis. And at the very same time they're having that internal debate, they're getting attacked from the outside because the way of life they were calling people to was so radical that some of their competitors, peers at the University of Paris, actually wrote treatises that thought that mendicancy itself was an invention of Antichrist. That the arrival of the Franciscans and the Dominicans was a sign that Jesus was coming back soon. Indeed, it did prove rather difficult, in light of all of this, to translate the Franciscan form of life into the kind of legal categories that establish you know, religious communities in this way. The radical dimension of poverty as practiced by Francis's companions eventually was adapted to these institutional circumstances. And I think it's fair to say that the Franciscan family was and remains haunted by their founding as something they've fallen away from. On the other hand, the Franciscan movement proved to be remarkably flexible and adaptable to a variety of circumstances. I won't go into the story now, but you know, Francis inspired Claire of Assisi, who was a woman of noble birth, to come and follow. And Francis, I think wisely, although she wasn't happy with it, said to her, women can't wander on the street. It's not safe, and it's not fitting for women to wander as beggars on the street. So Claire and her sisters were cloistered. And then Claire worked for 25 years after that to ensure that the insight, the Franciscan insights about poverty, radical poverty, could be lived out within her cloistered community, which in a way is even harder than why, because you couldn't go out and beg. You had to wait for the food to come to you. Right. So anyway, that's a long battle there, but it shows that it's adaptable, right? And then, and maybe you heard a little bit about this last time, right? Francis seems to be one of the first to establish some kind of semi-formal form of life for other lay people who, for one reason or another, could not completely abandon their life and circumstances, but who wish to live in some measure according to the Franciscan ideal, a third order. And that still exists today. So the radical plurality of responses to the Franciscan charism in various circumstances has led to, well, there's an old chestnut joke, and you don't have to laugh because it's inside Catholic baseball, but I'll tell you the joke anyway, and I won't feel offended if you don't laugh, right? So what are the two things that God doesn't know? How much money the Jesuits have and how many different kinds of Franciscan there are. Ha ha ha, right? Ba-dum-bum. These are the jokes, folks. No, for Catholics, it's hilarious, I promise. But you know, that it inspired all of these various movements. That's borne witness to in the common folk wisdom of that joke. So in one sense, the Franciscan legacy can be seen as a success. And in another sense, as a failure. It's a success in the proliferation of so many communities and persons who take their inspiration from Francis and who try to emulate his life in whatever particular capacity they can. But it can be seen as a failure in that, almost by definition, the institutionalization of such a community has to undo some of the radical reimagining that Francis and his early followers undertook. But, perhaps, can we see the survival of this movement, both in the very beginning and thereafter, by submitting to the apostolic demands of the church? Could that be paradoxically a kind of lesser, a kind of being lesser? Could it be seen as a kind of yielding one's own sort of attachment to the radicalness of one's way of life? They may have blunted the radical edge, but was that also, in the eyes of Providence anyway, the vehicle by which that initial vision could be passed on to find new birth again? And indeed, we can look to the role of the life of Francis in the conversion of people like Ignatius of Loyola and the founding of the Jesuits, all the way down to its influence on Dorothy Day and Peter Maurin in the founding of the Catholic Worker, and even closer to our present in the founding of the evangelical community, The Simple Way, right across the river from me, by Shane Claiborne, and his fellow Eastern University evangelical students in the 1990s and early 2000s. You know, that's explicitly an echo of the Franciscan way of life. And that story continues to be told precisely because the community survived. What I want to suggest to you is that in the light of providence, even our failure in that respect can be a tool that God uses, right? If there's a temptation in the Franciscan vision, it's that this kind of rigorous and radical call, it's either all or nothing. And for Francis, it was, and we need new Francises. We need people who bear witness to that, and perhaps God is calling you or me to that. And we should always be open to that call and the existence of a Francis, of a Dorothy Day, right? These folks, their very presence sort of bears witness to that possibility and to the imminence of that call for each of us, at least the question that needs to be asked. And yet, if we can take it up in some small way, in our own way, right, maybe we shouldn't be so hard on ourselves. Okay, closing. What can we learn from the Franciscan movement as we consider our own desire to resource and retrieve? For one, I think we can take inspiration from Francis to discern what great obstacles of our own age we have to the radical forms of discipleship. In the emergent days of the commercial economy, the rejection of money and its status was a key insight that opened up the Franciscan way of discipleship, right? In our own late modern world, right, we should ask, is wealth still that pressure point or hinge of our cultural self-construction and self-elevation? Are there other such idolatrous strategies of insulation, maybe we could call them, from our intimate dependence on God? I think that's an open question, right? I think that the question does change a little bit if you're at the beginning of the commercial economy and if you're in the later stages of it. That may be a different question. I don't know. Second, I think we can benefit from the reminder that whatever we discern as a key point of resistance, the end goal is discipleship and not simply resistance. And I'm just echoing what Rod said last night about the Benedict option. Any countercultural insight that does not lead to a deeper participation in the body of Christ and into a deeper life in the triune God is simply political posturing. Lastly, I think we can take courage from the radical willingness of Francis to strip away any false peace and security and to cast ourselves upon the wave, as C.S. Lewis says in Paralandra. And in that spirit, let me close with one last story from Francis that's always troubled me but has never left me either. It's a bit for me like a Zen koan in its capacity to uncover things in my own life and prayer. And so I offer it to you in that spirit. This is Francis's teaching on true and perfect joy. One day at St. Mary's, Blessed Francis called Brother Leo and said, "Brother Leo, write this down." And Leo responded, "Look, I am ready." "Write down," said Francis, "what true joy is." A messenger arrives and says that all the masters of Paris have entered the order. "Write, this is not true joy." Or that all of the prelates, archbishops, and bishops beyond the mountains, as well as the kings of France and England, have entered the order. "Write, this is not true joy." Again, that my brothers have gone to the non-believers and converted all of them to the faith. Or again, that I have so much grace from God that I heal the sick and perform many miracles. I tell you, true joy does not consist in any of these things. And Brother Leo says, "What is true joy then?" I return from Perugia and arrive here in the dead of night. It's wintertime, muddy, and so cold that icicles have formed on the edges of my habit and keep striking my legs, and blood flows from those wounds. Freezing, covered with mud and ice, I come to the gate, and after I've knocked and called for some time, a brother comes and asks, "Who are you?" "Brother Francis," I answer. "Go away," he says. "This is not a decent hour to come wandering about. You may not come in." When I insist, he replies, "Go away, you're simple and you're stupid. Don't come back to us again. There are many of us here like you, and we don't need you." I stand again at the door and say, "For the love of God, take me in." And he replies, "I will not. Go to the Croziers next door and ask them." "I tell you this," said Francis, If I had patience and I did not become upset, true joy, as well as true virtue and the salvation of my soul would consist in this. Thank you for your kind attention. I wish you joy, though you may not thank me for it.
The Ancient Evangelical Future Conference is hosted annually by the Robert E. Weber Center at Trinity School for Ministry. This recording is a production of Whitchurch Publishing, trusted resources from Trinity School for Ministry, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.tsm.edu.